This podcast is intended for investment professionals only. All investing involves risk.
What can the summer of sport tell us about the power of the world's biggest brands? How can brand value be quantified? And why might investors seek to add exposure to the owners of the strongest global brands? I'm Harry, a content manager at LGIM, and today my guests will be answering those questions. They are Henry Farr, a director at Brand Finance, which is the world's leading brand valuation consultancy, and Ellie Piscopiello, who is a senior ETF analyst here at LGIM. Welcome, Henry and Ellie.
Thank you for having us, Harry.
Hi, no worries.
Harry. Hi, Ellie. So when I think of a global brand, I imagine the name of a company, its logo, and I think of luxury goods companies. Henry, when you talk about brands, what specifically do you mean?
Thanks, Harry. So I think it's probably important at the outset to kind of define what we mean by brand. I think it's understandable to view that as a logo that you might bear on some clothing or on a car, but it's actually quite a lot more than that. At a technical level, we define it as a kind of trademarks and their associated IP. And the value of that brand is in the brand owner, that's the company that owns the brand, their ability to affect how stakeholders perceive the brand to create financial benefit for the brand. So you mentioned, obviously, kind of a luxury is obviously one we think of because it's in our faces. As consumers, we see these. We see a Dior bag, we see Armani shoes, we see a Mercedes-Benz drive past us. But the value goes beyond just that. An easy way to think of a brand is like a mental shortcut. It immediately tells you what to expect if that brand has a reputation. For instance, within airlines, we wouldn't just say that the luxury brands are the best brands. Ryanair has a very good brand, but for a very different reason why Emirates has a very good brand. With Ryanair, I know I can get something cheap. If they released a line of furniture, I know it would probably work and it would probably be quite cheap. And I'd be happy with that. If Emirates released a line of furniture, I know I'm paying a premium, but I'm getting something good. So to come back to that idea of kind of a mental shortcut, it's through the efforts of a marketing team and the branding team to build up these perceptions among consumers so that they can generate the suitable economic benefits to the brand owner.
Great, that makes sense, Henry. A different way of thinking about it, more in-depth way of thinking about it than most of us are probably used to. Ellie, I wonder if I can turn to you next to talk about sporting events, which have been on our minds recently with Wimbledon, the Euros and the Olympics as well. Sponsorships have obviously become hugely visible at all of those events. And presumably that sort of exposure can be very valuable for companies that want to promote their brands. I wonder if you can give us some numbers around the value of sponsorship at some of the big sporting events, and also talk a bit about the potential benefits of sponsorship for brands, event organisers, and also perhaps the athletes who participate.
Let's start from the Olympics. The Olympics this year is expected to bring in about $1.3 billion in sponsorship from a mix of domestic partners, that's about 60 companies, plus international partners. That's not far behind the total expected to be raised by ticket sales. This demonstrates the importance of sponsorship for the economics of large-scale events. For brands, events like the Olympics provide an opportunity to connect with a truly global audience and to capitalize on the association with international sporting achievements. Top athletes can make large sums of money through sponsorship. Roger Federer's endorsement portfolio is estimated to be worth almost $100 million, making him the world's highest paid athlete in 2020. Last year, he was still in the top 10, even though he'd retired from professional tennis. But it's not just about the paycheck. As well as top-of-the-line sports equipment, sponsorships can provide athletes with access to elite training facilities and support staff. Their association with highly regarded brands can also lead to additional opportunities and support their reputation as a top-flight player. Serena Williams' long-standing proximity to Nike is just one example.
Yeah, I think I'll pick up there. I think it's interesting to hear you talk about kind of the associations these people get by being with a brand from both the athlete or the event, in the case of the Olympics coming up, and the brand. I think quite long gone are the days of sponsorships being determined by a brand manager who sponsors, or sorry, who supports a particular football team, or maybe particularly likes going to the cricket or the golf, and they sponsor it for a box. Instead, brands are looking at this quite scientifically. And there's two areas you're looking at with the sponsorship, really. There's awareness, which is just how many eyeballs are you getting on your brand? And then there's association. And that is, do I want to be seen as innovative and forward-thinking? Going to sponsor F1. Do I want to be seen as populous and for everyone? Going to sponsor a Football World Cup. But I think the Olympics, where it stands out as kind of an asset for a brand, that is, to associate itself with, is it's both. Football World Cup, what is it, 32 teams, 32 countries? Olympics, all of the countries, pretty much, barring a few. So you've got truly global appeal. You've got demographic kind of range across ages, income brackets, genders. Everyone watches the Olympics. And it is held up as this kind of, it's the pinnacle of prestige, right? It's winning that Olympic medal. There's something about an Olympic medal that just shows you've worked at your craft. It's not really the Football World Cup where everyone sees, you know, these are teams and they go off and they play for their clubs, and that's really the main event for these men and women who play for football teams. Instead, the Olympics is the pinnacle of all of these sports, really, for athletics, swimming, cycling, etc. So if you're a brand, putting yourself alongside that, and you began to be seen as the pinnacle of your industry. And we're seeing lots of brands this year. You get the main headline sponsors, like we've had Coca-Cola in the past. But then this year, we've got one of AB InBev's brands, Corona, are releasing Corona Zero in the last year, and they're going to be sponsoring the Olympics this year. It's the first beer brand to ever sponsor an Olympic Games. There are non-alcoholic beer brands, and you can see there eyeballs on a new brand. You're getting that awareness, but also the association. It's, okay, I can be an athlete, but I can also drink, because here's a non-alcoholic option that can align with success in the same way.
Yeah, it's interesting, Henry. I saw the non-alcoholic beer sponsorship. I thought it was an interesting example of how a sponsorship can be used to launch a new product as well as building on an established brand that we've all seen before. I wonder if I can ask, how does branding activity vary depending on how recognized a product is in the first place?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I think something to bear in mind is that Corona Zero is being launched by AB InBev, Anheuser-Busch InBev, the biggest beer company in the world. Not many brands get to launch themselves with an Olympic sponsorship, right? So realistically, the type of marketing you do will depend a lot on where you are in kind of your product life cycle. We can think of two types of marketing. You've got brand building, which is slow, building up connotations over time that can't be rushed. And then you've got activations, things like a sponsorship, where you are getting in right in the faces of consumers and trying to provoke a short-term purchase. You want, it's a kind of an advert like you see on a billboard. Whereas long-term brand building is built less through advertising and more through product and service and availability, getting it in shops, letting people know what it is, rather than just it's here. And I think over time, you see, to be a successful brand, to build sales, you have activation. But to build a successful brand, it needs to be more long-term thinking. And then you can have successful brands which go on beyond the company. Just because a company goes bust, their brand can still have value. Recently, we've seen brands like Thompson in recent years, the travel agent, go bust as a company. But the brand was bought up by investors, but they knew it still held value. Or you get a brand that's perhaps on the way down in terms of its current product sales, but the emotional connection is still there with consumers. One example is we saw with the Barbie movie last year. Barbie toy sales were down, but there was still an entire generation and demographic of people to whom that brand had appeal. In the same way where a company can go bust, but that and move out of a building, the building still has value and it can still be repurposed and reused because those connotations in the brand case still remain.
So sticking with value for investors, why might the owners of global brands be attractive, Ellie? What kind of financial characteristics have they tended to have? And how have they performed historically in different phases of the economic cycle?
Historically, the companies that own the strongest brands have demonstrated higher profitability, higher efficiency in terms of higher return on equity, and higher returns to shareholders via dividends and share buybacks compared to mega cap peers. If an investor wants to target quality companies with robust financial characteristics, this is a great start, but they might also want to consider additional screening processes, such as adding an ESG overlay. There is a sort of a virtuous circle, I would say, whereby investing in a strong brand pays off in terms of raising the profile or raising the value of the brand, which in turn tends to translate into better performance, more capital available to invest in the brand, and so on. This has made such companies traditionally more resilient over the long term. In good times, strong brands grow value faster. In tough times, they recover faster than competitors.
Why is that the case? Why have they tended to bounce back quicker than weaker brands?
First reason, during recessions, marketing budgets typically get cut, but brands rely on the historical brand value that they have built through time. That's the most critical asset at these times. It is intangible, but it is strategic. Another reason is that these companies might not need to cut back on advertising as much as competitors during downturns, and this enables them to retain market share through time. Ultimately, it comes down to whether a brand is delivering value for money during challenging times. This doesn't necessarily mean cheap, but what is perceived by the customer as offering more value. Is there an emotional connection? Is the product meeting the customer's needs? Will the customer still pay a premium for the safe, established, and trusted brand?
I think Henry mentioned earlier on that these ideas aren't restricted to the luxury sector. That's right, isn't it?
Yes, Harry, that's right. Actually, this spans across many sectors. Of course, having a strong brand makes more of an impact in sectors that are more consumer-facing, like consumer services, communications, technology, and even consumer staples. In sectors like materials, industrials, or utilities, there is more sensitivity to prices. Energy bills, utilities are a great example. Do we really look at the brand? But when it comes to buying a new phone, I'm pretty sure most of us know which one we will get, even if it comes with a high price tag. And same for our food shopping. We pick our trusted brands. So it's not just about luxury.
I think at the practical level, to the point around kind of in recessions, how big brands do well, it's because it's really expensive to launch a brand. I mean, we spoke earlier, you know, AB InBev are able to go and get a sponsorship of the Olympics. Not everyone can do that. And so in a recession where it's marketing budgets are low, it's really hard to launch anything new, especially in, I mean, COVID accelerated a lot of that. You know, we're speaking about luxury, we've also spoken about beer. If you are trying to start a new beer brand, you do it through off-trade, which is pubs and restaurants. But when that's shut, they weren't able to at all. So I think kind of that's why you see this absolute glut now of new beer brands seem to be popping up everywhere you look, because essentially they were starved for 2 years. The big companies, the big brands, the known brands did so well because they were the only ones you could buy, really. It was incredibly hard to launch anything during that time.
Given that brands exist across all different sectors, Ellie mentioned a number of different sectors a second ago, and operate in different countries, completely different markets around the world, Henry, given your line of work, how do you compare them with each other? How does the company that you work for quantify the financial value of a brand?
Yeah, so we're really interested in the financial value of brands. As a company, we're looking to bridge the gap between marketing and finance, help a marketer make their brand understandable to the financial audience, or vice versa, for a financial audience to understand the value of brands. And the key factors we're looking at are what sector that brand operates. In some sectors, brand is very important in decision making. Say some of the brands we've spoken about today, beers, automobiles, apparel. In some, it's less important, logistics or oil and gas. And then we'd look at the strength of the brand. We conduct an extraordinary amount of market research to understand if people know what the brand is. Do they like the brand? Would they recommend it to a friend? What do they think of it? All of these factors contribute to the strength of a brand. And then we're looking at the actual financial power of that brand. How much revenue is it actually generating for the brand owner? Because that's where the value lies. So those three factors are key in how we would value a brand: the sector it operates in, how strong it is within that sector, and how much financial return it is generating at that time and into the future.
Excellent. Thanks, Henry. So I thought a fun way of ending today's podcast might be with some of our personal favourite facts and figures about well-known brands. So I'll kick us off. I've always been fascinated by graphic design. So mine is about one of the world's best known trademarks, which is the Nike swoosh, which, having looked it up on Wikipedia, I can tell you, was created in 1971 by Carolyn Davidson while she was a graphic student at Portland State University. And she was paid a whopping $35 for her efforts creating the iconic logo for the shoewear brand. But in 1983, Nike co-founder Phil Knight, recognizing Carolyn's efforts, gave her a gold and diamond swoosh Nike ring to express his gratitude, along with a stock that would today be worth more than $3 million. So her efforts did not go unrewarded in the end. Ellie, any pop trivia related to brands that you'd like to share?
I like some history pop trivia, especially if they involve traveling to the Caribbean. Our listeners may be familiar with Captain Morgan. Henry Morgan was actually a famous buccaneer, knighted by King Charles II for his success against the Spanish fleet in the Caribbean. A team of archaeologists some years ago discovered some iron cannons on the shores of Panama, but they couldn't continue their survey because they ran out of funding. And Captain Morgan, the rum brand, came forward and decided to subsidize costs. Eventually, they identified cargo boxes, chests, and a wooden hull, which belonged to one of his ships that were sunk during the sacking of Panama City.
They really went the extra mile to bring their brand to life there.
They did, yes. And reconnecting to your initial point, Harry, about the role of sponsorship, this is not pop trivia such, I would say, but rather a pop thought. There is an ongoing shift in the world of football to move away from betting sponsorships and to stop advertising gambling companies on jerseys. Some teams have been replacing betting companies with crypto exchanges. Of course, regulators are enforcing rules about what may and may not be ethical, also beyond gambling or betting. But perhaps this is also a sign of a shift towards new trends and new themes that are catching the attention of the new generation of fans and different types of companies that emerge and try to establish an emotional connection with their customers.
On Ellie's point on the gambling, there's one another one on the gambling sponsors, that is. I read recently that one of the reasons why there are so many gambling front-of-shirt sponsors, because in China, it's illegal to advertise gambling companies, but they can't actually blur out if it's the front-of-shirt sponsor. So whereas on a billboard, they are changed depending on the country you're in. If you're in France, you'll see a different ad to if you're watching a football match in England, but they can't blur out the front-of-shirt. Which is why these companies pay so much to be front of shirt, because they know that they're the only way to get global advertising.
Henry, how about you? Any interesting facts to share?
My favourite one actually is about Haagen-Dazs ice cream. I don't know if either of you, do either of you know what Haagen-Dazs means?
I don't.
It means absolutely nothing, actually. Although it sounds like a kind of a Scandinavian ice cream company, it actually was started by a couple who lived in New York who had, I believe, wanted to start a European sounding company. And Ruben Mattis, the husband of the couple, stayed up all night thinking of the most Scandinavian name he could possibly think of. And that was Haagen-Dazs. So if you spoke to someone from Denmark or Sweden or Norway and said Haagen-Dazs, it's complete nonsense. It means absolutely nothing. They just thought it sounded good. And they've clearly been quite successful in pulling that off.
Excellent fact, Henry. Thanks very much for sharing that. Well, thanks so much for your time today, Ellie and Henry, and thank you to all our listeners.
As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. The views expressed in this podcast are those of Legal & General Investment Management Limited, as at the date of publication. This podcast is for information purposes only, and we are not soliciting any action based on it. The information discusses general economic, market or political issues and/or industry or sector trends. It does not constitute research or investment, legal or tax advice. It is not an offer or recommendation or advertisement to buy or sell securities or pursue a particular investment strategy. Assumptions, opinions, and estimates are provided for illustrative purposes only. There is no guarantee that any forecast made will come to pass. No party shall have any right of action against Legal & General in relation to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Where this document contains third-party information, the accuracy and completeness of such information cannot be guaranteed, and we accept no responsibility or liability in respect of such information, not for distribution to any person resident in any jurisdiction where such distribution would be contrary to local law or regulation. Copyright 2024. Legal & General Investment Management Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. In Hong Kong, this material is issued by Legal & General Investment Management Asia Limited, regulated by the Hong Kong Securities and Futures Commission. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more content, you can check us out on X, formerly known as Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.